I've always struggled with finding time to manage my finances. At the end of a busy week, the last thing I want to do is spend time budgeting all of my expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions I no longer use. But now I use Rocket Money, and it does all that for me. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Stop wasting money on the things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Washington Post. That's rocketmoney.com/Washington Post.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and welcome to Capehart. From controversial court decisions to questionable ethics exercised by its most senior member, national attention on the Supreme Court has never been more intense. And its 6-3 conservative supermajority has shown no qualms about overturning precedent and creating new legal theories to achieve long-held goals of the right. In her new book, Nine Black Robes, Inside the Supreme Court's Drive to the Right and Its Historic Consequences, CNN senior Supreme Court analyst Joan Biskupic chronicles how we got to this point. In this conversation, first recorded for Washington Post Live on April 17th, Biskupic gets into the inner workings of the court, the role of the Federalist Society in shaping it, whether Chief Justice John Roberts still has control, and the complicated prominence of Justice Brett Kavanaugh.
He is super important. He is essentially the ideological center now. So he's got a lot of power as a potential fifth vote in either direction. But one thing that I do point up in the book is this double signaling he does to try to have it have it two ways.
So, Joan, as you write, the rightward shift on the court has been many years in the making. But what made the Trump era so different for the Supreme Court?
Well, let's start first with just the sheer number of appointees. He had 3 Supreme Court justices in just 4 years. Let's go back to Jimmy Carter, who had none. Bill Clinton and Barack Obama served 2 terms apiece, twice the number of years of Donald Trump, and they each only had 2 apiece. So you think back over like 20-some years, more than 20-some years, well back to Jimmy Carter, and you have only a total of 4 Democratic appointees. Meanwhile, you had Donald Trump with 3 in just 4 years. So the justices themselves are significant. Then the second thing would be the kinds of positions he was pushing through his Solicitor General. You know, very strong anti-regulatory moves, pushing to diminish individual rights, making headway, particularly on immigration right away from the start. And then finally, Jonathan, Donald Trump's attitude toward the judiciary as a whole. Just think of how much he tried to undermine the independence of the judiciary, saying things like, you know, it was an Obama judge that did that to me, or just wait till I get to the Supreme Court, I'll win there. He had a way of acting as if these judges and justices were his.
Right. He figured that the judiciary, these folks he appointed to the Supreme Court and throughout the judiciary, were to do his bidding. But that gets to another question about why conservatives and folks on the right supported someone like Donald Trump, who, just given what we knew about them in the past, that he's not someone they should have supported. Was there basically an implicit deal between Trump and the right to have him be president so that they could get the judicial appointments in place to carry out what they most wanted to do, and that was overturning Roe v. Wade?
You know, definitely that was part of his whole ascension as president. Just think of the timing of his candidacy. Antonin Scalia dies on February 13th, 2016. Donald Trump's campaign is really taking off. Eventually, he gets the Republican nomination that summer. And he uses the Scalia vacancy as part of his campaign. Remember what he did in May of 2016 when he came out with that list of potential Supreme Court appointees? Nobody had done that before. So that became a centerpiece of his campaign. And he was signaling to the right wing or to a broader Republican base, vote for me. I will deliver the Supreme Court for you. And so many of the names on that first list were names that would have been easily appointees of a George W. Bush. You know, they were all, with, I think, one exception, lower court judges. They were people within the main, but that's because those were names that were developed by the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society. Donald Trump essentially took the names that these Republican advocates gave him and put them out there, and that inspired confidence among Republican Party leaders that Donald Trump would, at least when it comes to the judiciary, do something that was very familiar and desirable for them.
Mm-hmm. And I'm great. You mentioned the Federalist Society, because in order to understand conservative judges on the bench, you have to understand the Federalist Society, but also Leonard Leo. Talk about the two of them and the role they played in shaping the federal judiciary and the Supreme Court itself.
Sure. I cannot overstate the effectiveness of Leonard Leo. The Federalist Society, so our audience knows, it was founded in the early 1980s. Antonin Scalia, in fact, was a faculty advisor as he was a professor at the University of Chicago. It was founded by three people who'd been together as undergraduates at Yale. One stays at Yale for law school. The other two go to the University of Chicago. And, you know, Ronald Reagan has just won. So they're thinking, we should have more of a voice on campus. And, you know, campuses were dominated by liberals at the time and arguably, you know, still are. And they decided they wanted to continue this debating society that they had at Yale back when they were undergrads. And so it started, Jonathan, as more of a forum for debate. At the very first Federalist Society meeting, Stephen Breyer was there, as was Robert Bork and Antonin Scalia, who at the time, as I said, was just a law professor. But it grew in its force and impact and its networking effect when Leonard Leo comes on in the early 90s. You know, it had been building over the years, just growing in strength and momentum. And Leonard Leo comes on in about 1991. And he, as you can tell from the book, and as you know from so many stories about Leonard Leo, is just a superb networker and money maker. You know, I know the Post has done really good investigative pieces on him, as have others. And I spent a lot of time interviewing him for this book. And he, as a high schooler, his name was, you know, Mr. Moneybags, because he could raise dough. And he has raised a lot of dough for the Federalist Society and for other very conservative causes. So every Republican appointee sitting on that court right now was screened in one way or another by the Federalist Society, including John Roberts, who met with Leonard Leo. John Roberts probably would have been appointed without any kind of seal of approval from the Federalist Society, but maybe the others would not have been.
So the Federalist Society is one stamp of approval, but another stamp of approval is Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. And you brought up 2016 and the vacancy that was on the court after the death of Justice Scalia. And it was in 2016 when Mitch McConnell was then Senate Majority Leader, who refused to give Merrick Garland a hearing when President Obama nominated him to the court to replace Scalia. What impact did that have, not granting Merrick Garland a hearing and thereby preventing him from joining the court? What did that have on the balance of power on the court, but also on the norms and standards and perception of the court?
It's been everything, Jonathan. You pair that with the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and I can't think of two more important episodes in the life of the Supreme Court in the past 5 years. This is such a great tale, because Mitch McConnell pulled off something he wasn't even sure he was going to be able to do, but he did. It's President's Day weekend, February 13th. It's a Saturday. Justice Scalia has died. Mitch McConnell gets word through somebody in Scalia's family with the channel of Leonard Leo. That's how he finds out. He finds out through Leonard Leo's connections, and Leonard Leo obviously went way back with Mitch McConnell. And he decides, Mitch McConnell is in, I'm not sure, I think he stopped over in the Virgin Islands, wherever he was going for this great vacation. He decides right then and there, he's going to tell everybody, we're not going to do anything to fill that seat. Now that's February. And of course the election's not until November of 2016. And he said later that if the Senate had been in session, this was President's Day weekend, if the Senate had been in session, he might not have been able to pull that off, because some of his Republican colleagues would have grumbled, as they kind of did, but they weren't all together. you know, he was able to take this action and then get people and get his colleagues in line over the upcoming days and weeks. And look at how effective it was. Now, the Democrats pushed back to an extent, but not very much. I remember that at the Democratic convention, Hillary Clinton and her people never even mentioned Merrick Garland's pending nomination at the time. So everyone kept thinking, well, Hillary Clinton will win. It won't matter that Mitch McConnell is blocking this seat. But obviously she didn't. And Mitch McConnell's blocking of that seat made all the difference than in an appointment of Neil Gorsuch. Now, it would have so swung the court to have had a Democratic appointee succeeding Antonin Scalia. And, you know, someone like Elena Kagan or Stephen Breyer, they were all looking forward to possibly then, you know, a liberal dominance. But that didn't happen, of course. And it was a switch of Neil Gorsuch for Scalia back in then. Neil Gorsuch comes on in April of 2017 after Donald Trump has taken the White House.
You know, you just mentioned something that I did not even put together or realize. And I remember where I was when Justice Scalia passed away. But the fact that Congress was in recess is what is probably the most pivotal thing, because you could imagine if Congress was in session and reporters were all around asking various members of the Senate, well, where are you on this or what should happen? That could have boxed out. Mitch McConnell probably wouldn't have been able to do what he did.
Yeah, and you know what else was happening that night, since you remember it? Do you remember there was a Republican debate in South Carolina? And Don McGahn is also in this loop. They're all together. You probably know, you know, there's that chapter in the book called The Triumvirate, and that's Mitch McConnell, Don McGahn, and Leonard Leo. And so also that fateful night of February 13th, 2016, where we all remember where we were, Don McGahn gets in touch with Donald Trump. Don McGahn at this point is he's like a key advisor, because obviously he eventually becomes White House counsel. But at that point, he's, you know, a lawyer to the campaign. He gets in touch with Donald Trump and he says, here are some names you can mention. You can say, you know, here are some people I'd put on the court. He mentions, if I remember right, Judge Pryor and Judge Sykes. Again, two people who probably any Republican president would have had on a list. And then he says, delay, during that debate. And again, setting the tone of whoever President Obama names, and eventually it was Merrick Garland about a month later, no action at all.
Mm-hmm. Also, you want to point out that Majority Leader McConnell's rationale was, well, we should let the American people decide at the ballot box who the president is to fill this vacancy. As you pointed out, this was February, the election was in November, but then fast forward 4 years and Justice Ginsburg passes away and there's an opening on the court mere weeks before the election, and Leader McConnell reverses course and pushes through with the quickness of the confirmation of Justice Amy Coney Barrett.
That's right. That's why I say it's a real match set. And then we have, you know, Neil Gorsuch, as I said, was a conservative swap for a conservative. But when we get to Amy Coney Barrett for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it's a whole different game here. And so Ruth Bader Ginsburg dies September 18th. And, you know, we're so close to the election. As soon as she's buried, Donald Trump says that he's actually, Donald Trump announced Amy Coney Barrett's name, if I remember right, before Justice Ginsburg was buried. It was it was after she was in the Capitol, remember? And they had had the ceremony. And then as she drives away, I remember as a reporter getting the word who he had chosen. And so, you know, it's just about a week later. And then her confirmation hearings are held pretty quickly. And then I believe it was October 26th that she takes her seat. And, you know, that's how close we were to the election, you know, in early November.
Oh, we can talk about the impact on the Dobbs decision, but I'm having a good time talking about the personalities involved here. Yeah. So let's keep going. Let's talk about two key figures on the court, Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Clarence Thomas. Justice Thomas has been the focus of a ProPublica expose on his relationship and business dealings with a billionaire donor. And this raises an audience question. This question comes up from Deanna McMahon from California. Deanna asks, what's going on with John Roberts? No public statement about the right or wrong of Clarence Thomas's activities. It seems that he has given up leadership of the court.
You know, I do think John Roberts could have been more vocal, but he's got a weak hand up with his colleagues. Yeah. You know, they have struggled behind the scenes and are still struggling behind the scenes on some sort of formal ethics code. And I believe that Chief Justice Roberts would like them to adopt that. But you can't handle that the way you'd handle a case. You can't say we're going to have a 6-3 ethics code. Six of us will abide by it and three won't. You know, so that's a real problem. And I think people have looked to John Roberts for some sort of moral leadership here. But just as we saw in the Dobbs decision, how he can't control everything, he definitely can't control everything behind the scenes when it comes to off-bench behavior, too.
So let's talk about the fact that he can't control things behind the scenes when it comes to the Dobbs decision with this 6-3 supermajority, conservative supermajority on the court. Is he Chief Justice in name only?
No, because, so he lost Dobbs. You know, he got part of what he wanted in Dobbs. He wanted to uphold the Mississippi ban on abortion at 15 weeks of pregnancy. He was with that. He just did not want them to go so far as to completely roll back Roe v. Wade, nearly half century of reproductive rights precedent. He just said, you know, he was somebody who was never favored abortion rights, but he definitely did not want to roll it back. And understandably so. I think you see the ramifications throughout the country, both legally and politically. But he didn't have the votes. But Jonathan, think of everything else that he's gotten. He's got a majority on how he feels about rolling back racial remedies. He has a majority for lowering the wall of separation between church and state. He's definitely with the majority in rolling back regulatory protections for the environment and public health protections. So he was with the majority on the Second Amendment. So I would say this is still John Roberts' court, but he did lose a significant case, a case that I have called the defining case of his generation, and that truly was a loss for him, but he certainly prevailed in many other ways.
Were you surprised, given how extensively and how long you've covered the Supreme Court, were you surprised that this Supreme Court overturned a precedent, a 50-year-old precedent like Roe versus Wade?
I used to say they never would do it. But once 2018 came along and Brett Kavanaugh succeeded Anthony Kennedy, and then especially when Amy Coney Barrett succeeded Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I started thinking maybe they will. I was one person who kept thinking the chief might pull out some sort of compromise at the very end in 2022. But Jonathan, I used to say they'll never overturn Roe because I thought it would have such political repercussions as well as legal repercussions. And, you know, just think of the other Republican appointees who over the years voted to uphold Roe, even though they said they wouldn't have wanted to be part of the 1973 court that approved it. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, Justice Anthony Kennedy, you know, they were people who voted to uphold it, even though they didn't like it. But this is a different kind of conservative now.
And what about the impact of the leak of the Alito draft?
Sure. It froze the votes. Okay, so, you know, I would kill to know who leaked it. You know, I don't know. The court doesn't know, it claims. And I kind of think after all the investigation they went through that if they knew, they would tell us. But I do not know who leaked it. But I can tell you what I believe it has been the effect, especially since I was tracking John Roberts during that time and trying to figure out whether he was making headway. And he kept working and working. And remember, that was a May 2nd leak. They had until the end of June to produce that opinion. And, you know, but once that leaked, it froze everybody in place. It was hard for any of the other justices to move over if they ever would have. If Brett Kavanaugh would have ever possibly moved over, it became impossible once it was so public.
Let's keep going down the list of personalities here. You mentioned Justice Brett Kavanaugh. He had a rough confirmation hearing in 2019. What role has he played on the court? And talk to us about his desire to be liked.
Okay, first of all, his role. He is super important. He is essentially the ideological center now. So he's got a lot of power as a potential fifth vote in either direction. Now, he usually does stick with his conservative fold, but sometimes he has joined the chief in moving over to the left. So he has a very powerful vote. Let's start with that. But one thing that I do point up in the book is this double signaling he does to try to have it have it two ways. He wants to vote against somebody, but then write an opinion that says, but, you know, I respect their point of view, even though he's voting against them. And, you know, I think one of the main examples of that was in the LGBTQ case of 2020, when the majority by a 6-3 vote expanded the understanding of Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act to cover gay and transgender workers who face bias, that they could use Title VII to sue. And Justice Gorsuch writes the opinion, you know, and the chief signs on. So you have two conservatives signing on to this opinion. And Brett Kavanaugh doesn't. And Brett Kavanaugh, but he writes this opinion saying, you know, but I think that people with the LGBTQ community should feel such, you know, pride in what they've accomplished. And this is not to diminish what they've done. So he had a way of always writing that kind of sentiment into decisions. And one thing I point out in the book is when I discovered that he had, should I bother even getting into the Department of Commerce case?
We've got less than 10 minutes and we still have to get through a couple more things.
But let's say there are there are other examples in the book.
Right. That's great. That's a great tease for Nine Black Robes. Okay. Next personality, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. Last year, she became the first Black woman ever confirmed to the Supreme Court. How has she changed the dynamics of the court, if at all?
Well, she has. First of all, she's just right in there immediately during oral arguments. You know, I just came from there this morning to, you know, as I was listening to cases. And, you know, she was a district court judge, as you remember, Jonathan, and she still has a bit of that district court judge thing going on of asking lots of questions, having lots of questions, and sometimes not being aware of, you know, the time that her questions can dominate, but they do. And they're good questions. She's there prepared. And you don't feel any kind of freshman effect here for the newest justice. But I have to say, we don't have many data points yet. She hasn't been, they haven't hand down many opinions at all. Our audience should know that they'll be in on Tuesday and Wednesday with opinions, but they are way behind on the number of opinions they've been giving. But so she hasn't been writing a lot yet, so we don't know exactly where she'll fall. I would say just at first blush, she seems to be aligning more with Justice Sonia Sotomayor than with Justice Elena Kagan. Justice Kagan could sometimes straddle the middle a little bit to work deals, but I think she'll be much more sticking with the left with this new dynamic on the court too.
Well, just in terms of personality type, I mean, you write in your book that Justice Sotomayor is the one who has been very vocal in her opinions and in her dissents, really taking it to the other side and the other side's arguments. And so, if I'm hearing you right, in Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, Justice Sotomayor now has backup.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a really good point. Because, you know, when I talk about so much of what happened in the Trump years, you know, it was Justice Sotomayor who would call him out on racism. She would call him out, and much more than any of her colleagues. And, you know, obviously Donald Trump isn't there right now, but I see Justice Jackson as being perhaps blunter in her writing than, for example, her predecessor, Stephen Breyer, was.
Mm-hmm. All right, I got to get you on two things in the 4.5 minutes that we have left.
Okay.
There's another factor that folks should know about the shadow docket. Explain the significance and why there's so much concern about the power it has.
Okay, so it's essentially the emergency docket, where the justice is here, rightly so, emergency cases, you know, coming up from death penalty, you know, last ditch death penalty appeals, trying to stop an execution. Or, for example, like what we've got now with the emergency situation for the medication abortion. That's right. Coming up to the Supreme Court in emergency posture. And for so many recent years, the justices had been essentially deciding the merits of cases on what has become known as the shadow docket, because it's a way that the justices resolve cases without full briefing and oral arguments. I do have to say, Jonathan, they have seemed more mindful of trying to slow down emergency cases that don't involve, for example, death row inmates, and to actually hear oral arguments and resolve cases. Because a major criticism of the shadow docket has been that they're making very consequential rulings without full briefing. And these are rulings that really affect all of us. And I'll give you an example. You know, remember the Texas abortion case, SB 8, they initially handled that on their shadow docket. They eventually did hear it in the fall of 2021. But that was, you know, how serious can you get? A 6-week ban on abortions in Texas. And there was a lot of pressure on handle a lot of their business comes up through this emergency docket. And the reason it's called the shadow docket is because they can act in ways that often don't seem fully transparent.
Right. You pointed out something that I didn't know, that the Supreme Court is called the Marble Palace. And so from the outside, it seems like a particularly chaotic time in the Marble Palace. But from the inside, are these external conditions even being felt?
I think they're feeling, certainly they felt the protest. Just think of how they had to ring that building with barricades and razor wire. Mm-hmm. So they felt that. They're definitely feeling the criticism over, you know, ethics issues. They're feeling the protests from people still from the Dobbs fallout. You know, several of them had protesters at their homes for several months. But it is still such a reserved place where everything runs, you know, like clockwork. When I was sitting in the courtroom this morning, it was very quiet. Starts right at 10 a.m. on the dot. There's a certain order to everything. This place is, you know, there are so many traditions that in some ways cushion it, that mm-hmm. they are protected from the outside within those marble walls. But more and more, I think they're facing a scrutiny. They're facing much more public scrutiny, much more watchdog scrutiny, much more congressional scrutiny, and much more media scrutiny. They used to escape a lot of that the other branches had.
Mm-hmm. We are over time, but I'm going to squeeze in this one last audience question. And real quickly, from Trevor Nevy from Washington, D.C., and a great Washington question. Are there any rumors about who will be the next to retire from the court?
That's a great question, because we always think of retirements, but I think we're set for a while. I actually think we're not going to see any retirement fingers crossed. Let me just say that. Fingers crossed. It's been unusual to have essentially 4 new justices in the past 5 years, right?
Right.
I mean, I can tell you it is. I don't have to say right. It is very unusual. I don't think we're going to see anybody go out willingly. Definitely none of those Republicans are going to leave under President Joe Biden's watch.
Right.
And I do not believe the two more senior Democrats, Justice Sotomayor and Kagan, are going anywhere yet. So no retirements in the near future, Trevor.
So there's so many more questions that I had, you know, about, you know, other precedents like Obergefell and Griswold and potential for Congress acting on ethics rules for the Supreme Court. But we are completely out of time. Joan Biskupic, author of 9 Black Robes, Inside the Supreme Court's Drive to the Right and Its Historic Consequences. Thank you so much for coming to Capehart on Washington Post Live.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Capehart. It's edited by Nick Roberts. We'll have new episodes for you every Thursday.
I'm Jonathan Capehart. You can find me on Twitter at CapehartJ.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.